Okay. I am going to read the questions. I'm going to give 15 minutes per question. I'm going to ignore the fact that my pen just exploded. And I'm going to start with the question number 10. And again, 15 minutes will be a hard stop, regardless of where we are. We can come back to it or talk about other things in the remaining, say, 20 minutes that we'll have for the rest of the class. So let's just dive right. Question number 10. Luxemburg argued that Marx's theory greatly transcends the needs of the working class in the matter of weapons for the daily struggle. Dunyevskaya says that this is wrong. Why? What, if anything, does this controversy have to do with the question of the proper role of a revolutionary organization?
I'll say something, but I'm really hoping other people haven't been speaking much or talk. Over. I'll just wait and see if somebody else pipes up. Over.
Stephanie, why don't you just go first and break the seal, as it were, and maybe other people will pipe in afterwards. Okay?
Sure. This is very succinct. I just wrote that theory is not transcendent to practice and struggle. You can't just apply it later. Part of the work, and it will be embodied in workers in their organizations. Those organizations are truly revolutionary in their struggles versus capitalism, then they are informed by theory. Over.
Okay. Anybody else?
Torev?
Yes, Torev.
Yeah, I was thinking along the lines of philosophy and theory should not just be used for daily struggle, whatever comes up. Philosophy and theory should also be used as sort of an overarching goal in terms of where are we? And where do we want to be with our class struggle, especially in the context of the revolutionary objective? And I thought that Raya Dyanevskaya felt that Rosa Luxemburg was thinking too much along the lines of, whatever is now, we need to fight right now. And Rosa Luxemburg might have lost sight of the overall goal. Over.
How are you?
Mike Alsason. Anne.
Okay, Anne, go for it.
I was supposed to say Anne, not Mike. It's not only that we need to see the overarching goal of a new society, it's that we need to think about it all the time, she's saying, that to practice dialectics from the start and not just leave it as Luxemburg thought, after the revolution, we need that, but to have it from the start is not only to have the perspective of the future society, but for it to be a pull on us now, so that the seeds of the future are in the present, and we are influenced by it all the time. Rye even concludes with this quote on the bottom of page 120, top 121 of Rose Luxemburg book. far from dialectics being an abstract question, it is this which impinges on Marx's philosophy of revolution. It is Marx who wasn't a Marxist so long as he was still a philosopher. Is it Marx who wasn't a Marxist so long as he was still a philosopher? Was scientific socialism achieved only after Marx, as Luxembourg put it, developed himself into a practical political fighter, her emphasis, only after he discovered the class struggle, war of the Communist Manifesto, etc.? And she says, the answer to this is no such simple matter as citing that even when Capital was already on the presses, Marx still proudly acknowledged authorship of his early work, The Holy Family. No, it was nothing that simple. Rather, what is involved is the whole question of a dialectic of thought, of liberation, the revolutionary nature of historical materialism. Actually, that wasn't the quote I wanted to read, but it's a good one. And yes, at the bottom of page 120, the question that concerns us here is this. Could Luxembourg's near tone deafness on philosophy have had an impact on the attitude to the theory of revolution in general? Okay, and that's sort of bringing it down to the nitty gritty of how it influences us immediately and everything. So it's not a question of approaching every struggle of workers and others with the handing out the critique of the Gotha program, as somebody suggested. That's not the question. The question is, how have we, the so-called professional revolutionaries, the small group like us who always seems to be around, how have we organized ourselves on the basis of philosophic ideas? And Riaz also singles out very much the question of how to begin anew, because no revolution follows a straight line. There are always high points and defeats. Nobody ever, you know, first mass strike goes straight to revolution. No. So the point is to have the intellectual tools to figure out how to begin anew, especially after the overthrow of capitalism, but from the get-go right now, and what do we do tomorrow? Over.
Hi, it's Ravi. I'm watching back on Twitter.
Go for it, Ravi.
Just on what Taras was saying, it's one of those things where that the idea of philosophy being something that's overarching and therefore is counterposed to the day-to-day struggle. It's one of those things where I think that kind of abstract presentation of something that's overarching and the kind of concrete things of what you experience in the here and now, the real situation on the ground, is that you have to continually mediate between the two, because there is no kind of ready-made answer that Marx's philosophy will give you in relation to direct events, but it's through bringing the two into a relationship and looking how to mediate that you get the answer to how the everyday struggles relate to the broader project of revolution in total. Over.
Andrew?
Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty straightforward question and straightforward disagreement. And it goes to the whole issue of self-mediation versus the transition versus a sort of a stagification of moving people, the masses, from where they are to something else. Or is Marxist theory and philosophy directly relevant in the daily struggle? I don't think it's a sophisticated question. I think Dunayevskaya guy is saying, you know, the preoccupation of the man in the street and the preoccupation of the theorist are the same. You know, can human beings be free? She talks about the 49-50 coal miners' general strike, where the miners were raising the question of what kind of labor is human, and they were connecting with the humanism of Marx's, you know, essay on alienated labor and such. I think the only difficulty here, and it's a real difficulty, is that one can look at what is happening in the daily struggle. One can read ongoing events in different ways. So from a certain way of looking at what the daily struggle is about, Marx's, you know, theory is not directly relevant and greatly transcends. From another vantage point, that's not the case. So I think that in terms of what this has to do with the proper role of a revolutionary organization, it goes to the question of, you know, is the role of a revolutionary organization to move people from where they are to a higher vantage point, or to reconnect with them, to connect with people at the highest point where they are, in which case Marx's theory might be directly relevant, although that might not be, you know, numerically the most predominant thing that's going on. Over.
We have a few more minutes, just a few, if anybody else wants to say anything, if any of the comments have brought anything up or raised any questions.
Mike?
Yes, Andrew.
There's an IM from Eric that you might want to read or something that I think is on this question.
Yeah, okay, I will do that. So Eric says, this may not be Raya, but Eric instead, but just intuitively, theory always needs to come back to how we go on, how we go in our day-to-day lives. Not only is it desirable, but it is necessary. Perhaps my citing the Black Panthers is getting tiresome here at this point, but they did a lot in the American Revolutionary Movement, as far as I can tell, to not separate theory from practice. For them, their Maoism, which was more Fanonism, informed the fact that they would start their survival programs pending revolution. Without their theoretical work and carrying on, to some extent, Frantz Fanon's work, that I don't think the Black Panther Party would have been any different from, say, the other gangs in urban areas and in Appalachia. I kind of see the same thing with socialist parties that have taken over in Europe, which I guess also goes back to the Gotha program itself. Separating theory from the rest of it seems to lead down a path of favoring practical politics rather than a unity, I guess, between theory and practice. I may be completely off base here, though. Thanks, Eric. No, I think I was just sloppily reading it as first time, but we get it. Thank you. Any other thoughts? Quickly, otherwise I'm going to move on. Okay, I'm going to move to question number 11, which is the second question of this class. Dunyevskaya seems to suggest that Marx's critique of the Gotha program and the unified party that resulted from it applies as well to the German Social Democratic Party led by Kautsky. A. Why does she not accept that, quote, adherence to Marx's theories, end quote, makes all the difference? And B. what is the, quote, totally different basis for the establishment of a Marxist party, and quote, that the CGP formulated. So if we turn to power of negativity, we'll get people who want to speak on that. Yes, Anne. Go ahead.
I'll just give a real short answer based on the specifics she takes up there. You all know that the Second International was full of reformists like Bernstein and whole terrible people, and Kautsky was the head of the party, and he was supposed to be a real Marxist, so that's why, you know, she's setting up this question of was it enough that he adhered to Marxist theory, and Donevskaya doesn't think so, because he did some really bad stuff, like not publishing the Critique of the Ghost program, and she says he basically twisted Marx's idea of organization into the vanguard party concept. So it's not enough to claim to stick to his revolutionary consequences of his analysis of capital. Over.
Does anybody want to speak on B? What is the totally different basis for the establishment of a Marxist party that the Critique formulated? Yes, Torev, go ahead.
Question B, wouldn't it be the smashing of the law of value on the way to, transforming capitalism to the lower phase of communism? And once the lower phase has been reached, to abolish the division of mental and manual labor on the basis of developing the productive forces further. Over.
Yes, go ahead, Andrew.
No, I don't think that's the issue, Thoreau, because that's an issue of adherence to Marxist theory. And, you know, you could be totally in agreement with Marx's theory. And, I mean, that's the way they excuse the whole thing, you know, the critique of the Gotha program, and that was just about the LaSallian. But I don't think it was just that. I think that, you know, a lot of these people knew better than what they had embedded and embodied in their program, the Gotha program. But they were being, quote, pragmatic, close quote. And it's not really just a question either of opportunism, you know, versus adherence to principle. It goes to the question of, are you directly going to connect with the great mass of people outside on the basis of the highest point? Or are you going to, you know, address them at a lower level? And, you know, I think it was Eric who did a really nice typographical thing a number of weeks back in the email correspondence where, you know, he said, like, well, you could have, like, you know, we do have, like, Marxist groups, you know, who will fight for $15 an hour pay, you know, in big type, and then in low type, in very small type, you know, stuck backwards somewhere, in the back somewhere, oh yeah, we need socialism. Or you're going to scream, you know, this is our goal, we need a new society, and making, you know, the 15-hour struggle part of that. So it's not a question of what the small group, you know, the group like us believe. I think it's a question of how we relate to the great mass of people. Are we engaging with them at the level of the highest point that Marx's theory, Marx's philosophy, and what's come since has reached? Or are we stagifying and trying to say, well, this is all in advance of them, and they can't appreciate that, and we're going to have to move them step by step along. I mean, Marx says, you know, look, this program is a retrogression because it is retrogressing in the realm of theory, and not that you people don't know this, it's that you're not embodying this in your electoral program, you know, for the whole of society here in Germany. Over.
It's Ravi here.
Yes, Ravi, go ahead.
I mean, it sort of feeds into the next question as well, but I think Lenin's kind of characterization of his opposition in what is to be done as economism, which is basically tail-ending the masses, and it was that whole idea that rather than present the highest point of what theoretical understanding has been kind of grasped by the masses and it's possible to say, you relate to the lowest common denominator, which doesn't establish the highest theoretical point that is capable of the working class being stabilized around.
Torev,
go ahead.
I would like to ask a question. When Andrew talks about the highest point of what Marx gives us, or the highest point of Marx's theory, doesn't that mean his analysis of how capitalism functions and how the conflicts and contradictions can be overcome, i.e. smashing the law of value? Over.
Sort of, I might be wrong. I think Andrew was talking about the highest point in which the masses have reached, either cognition and practice or just practice. I think that's the case. Andrew, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I was actually, that sort of got me trying to remember where I read this quote from page 21 of Power of Negativity, where Dostoevsky talks about, in the second paragraph on page 21, in the middle of the paragraph, the quote starts of Hegel, in the absolute method, the notion preserves itself in its otherness and the universal in its particularization, in the judgment and in reality. It raises to each next stage of determination the whole mass of its antecedent content, and by its dialectical progress not only loses nothing and leaves nothing behind, but carries with it all that it has acquired, enriching and concentrating itself upon itself. That could be applied maybe to some sort of mode of production, subsuming the last one and carrying with it the highest point, but maybe the masses of activity as well. I don't quite know how to pull that apart, but that it's just evocative of that for me. Over.
Let's say something on this.
I heard Andrew first, and then who was that just now?
Peter Glover, but Andrew first, yeah.
Thanks, Peter. Andrew,
yeah,
Andrew, go ahead.
I'll just clarify. In regard to the prior question, Ken, I was referring to the highest point, you know, reached by the masses. And question with regard to question 11, I was talking about the highest point of Marx's theory, but the issue is not that the basis is the highest point of Marx's theory, but the totally different basis for the establishment of a Marxist party, the CGC formulated, is what I think Dostoevsky is saying, is that the highest point of theory and philosophy should be directly projected to the masses in the daily struggle and become part of it. So it's not a question of, you know, what is the high point of theory? It's not a question of what do we think? It's a question of the relationship between what we think and what we project. Over.
Peter, go ahead.
The issue of the Gotha program or any party program, I completely agree, it's right to have, you know, to state things from the highest point. But I think a revolutionary party or the German Social Democratic Party was facing practically, not so much the party program, but many, many minimal demands. It was a massive organization. And day to day, with the growth of trade unions and so on, the activists and so on were facing enormous... The challenges were day-to-day challenges of, you know, this group of workers wants this demand, another group of workers wants this demand. There's enormous unevenness of what the demands are. And trying to link them together, it is possible many times to link them together, but very often too, it's not possible to link them because you're just faced with a struggle. It might be in an immediate workplace, and you've just got to deal with that particular struggle. And it's very difficult to keep that very high level. So sometimes you've just got to deal with, and I can perfectly understand the difficulties faced. I agree that with the activists and German social democracy, the issue, I think, is about this false, the unity on a false basis. That is really important. But I think German social democratic, whoever they were, the activists, the people who were putting in an illegal time, you know, they couldn't, you know, say exactly what they really felt. It was very difficult. You had to hide, in many cases, the official program, even up until the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century. I think Kautsky's Road to Power in 1909, you had to change it. The German Social Democratic Party wouldn't let him put it out because it broke, apparently, it broke German electoral law. Some people could have been put in prison. So they did have this other problem as well in terms of the law and how to deal with it, you know, day-to-day issues that, you know, on the surface aren't revolutionary issues. Over.
This is Stephanie. I have some questions around this, but I'll hold. I think I can remember what they are if people want to. This is still relevant to everything. everything that's being said on 11, but I'll hold for a bit, unless you want me to go over.
No, I'd appreciate it if you held it, Stephanie, because 15 minutes is up for this question, so we're going to move on, but definitely bring it up when we have time at the end. So I'm going to move to question 14. Question 14, really, question 3. Lenin's The State and Revolution is rooted in the CGP, so what does Dunyanskaya mean when she writes that no revolutionary studied CGP as, quote, the actual or actual perspective for the whole movement, end quote? Should they have done so?
Well, I'll have a go then, Ravi.
Go for it, Ravi. And I think that the answer kind of, there's a nice way from the last sort of points that were made. I forget who it was that was actually talking about Kautsky and repression, but maybe we'll talk about that. Go ahead, Ravi.
Well, I think that there's, I can't remember in which work it is, but Lenin had this formulation of the task of revolutionaries in different countries, which was that despite the overall aim being kind of international revolution and the establishment of world communism, the specific ways in which that would be translated according to the situation in particular circumstances would pose different problems for Marxists on the ground. And to make something the perspective for the whole movement is tricky. I mean, it can be done, but it has to be done in such a way that it's differentiated according to specific circumstances. So, for example, in some situations around oppressor and oppressed nations, to give the same message about what the nature of the struggle is, it's slightly unmediated if you're dealing with trying to challenge chauvinism amongst the masses of the kind of oppressor nation, as opposed to keying into the kind of search for freedom of the oppressed nation. And so the way in which you present the ideas and mediate them will be slightly different. So I think in the situation of using, and I kind of alluded to this in my last email, is that for a country like Russia, in which the peasantry was the overwhelming majority of the mass of the population, and the working class were a minority within there, and the kind of conscious element that had been kind of developed within the working class that were aligned with the Bolsheviks was even smaller still, then to have the CGP as the kind of perspective of the whole movement, I think was quite difficult in that period. And you can see why it was something that was, as a way of relating both to the situation on the ground in Russia and for the whole movement, would be very tricky to pull off in the same document. Over.
Thank you, Ravi. Anybody else?
Mike, I'll go, but... But maybe we can try to get some of the people who haven't spoken to speak soon after me. No. I think maybe Ravi's trying to make it too specific as to exactly what the strata of the working class class you're working with in a particular place. I think that Raya's point is more general. And she does say on page 157 that the question cites, but just right before the bottom of the page, the very end of that long paragraph, she says, unfortunately, Lenin's philosophic reorganization dealt with the concept of the revolutionary smashing of the bourgeois state, not with the other crucial factor in Marx's critique of the Gotha program, the inseparable relationship of philosophy to organization itself. So I think the actual perspective for the whole movement is the perspective of organizing on the basis of philosophy, whatever the manifestations may be in a particular struggle. The point is to keep that philosophic grounding. So she's saying, I think, that Lenin was concentrating on smashing the state, seizing power, but that's not the same issue as transforming it from a capitalist state into something else. So it's keeping that perspective of communism, lower phase, higher phase, I think. And she's talking about how our organizations should function, not only now, but also, not ours, but organizations should function after the fall of capitalism. But certainly she's talking about us right here and now also. I wrote something the other day, but I don't know, let me just read a sentence. Marxist humanism is not a collection of positions on organizational questions. Even if those are such profound organizational questions as the need for theory, an appreciation of movements from below, trying to get Marx right, etc., these are important, but none of them is the whole, and philosophy is not just a collection of positions. And when you just list things like that, it's very, very abstract. I wrote this to someone who claimed I was abstract, but I thought his just saying he agreed with all these things was extremely abstract, as they weren't related to what's going on in the world, and all these things have to be made concrete in terms of what's going on. So the point is to grasp the philosophy from the inside out and have it play a role in everything you do. Maybe this time, maybe we talk a little bit later about the anti-police brutality movement that's growing by leaps and bounds in this country, and the different strains we've seen in the demonstrations, and when it's reaching towards universals of freedom, and when it's just talking about democratic reforms. Over.
Peter Jones. Yes, Peter.
What he does not see, what Dunayevskaya thinks she sees, is that Marx has laid a very different basis for Marxist organization there. Now, she was extremely appreciative of Lenin's position in 1920 in the trade union debate, where he opposed both the workers' opposition, who wanted to trade unionize the state, and on the one hand, and Trotsky's position, which is basically to militarize the economy, on the other. And Lenin was saying that the unions needed to become schools of communism. And I think that is part of, that's a practical illustration of the way I think she thinks that things could have gone. I mean, obviously there were huge practical problems in Russia. Nothing could have saved the revolution when they didn't get help from Germany and they didn't get help from China and elsewhere. But I think that the issue is perspective for the whole movement. We have to think about what that means. And for those who've been following the email discussion, what I want to call attention to is this whole discussion revolved around Leo Panitch. You know, so what we had were people who would say, and Ann was talking about this, oh, I agree with you about X, I agree with you about Y, I agree with you about Z. But then when it comes to the question of what to do, they're totally down with Leo Panitch and his building of a party that can turn the working class, into a class in the sense of desiring a new society and all of this. So you get a divorce between what people supposedly agree with and their perspective of, in other words, what to do. At least I consider that to be a real divorce between those two things. So, let me try to formulate this succinctly, because it's not that easy. But let me try to rephrase it as follows. Why did not anybody look at Marx's criticism of that program and say, look, what a Marxist organization should be doing is projecting and working out how to project in the daily struggle at every moment, no matter what's happening, it takes some working out, but why is it not projecting, you know, the highest points of Marxist philosophy, of Marxist theory? And why is it, when it comes to practical work, doing something else? Over.
This is Stephanie. I just want to know one of the words that Andrew used. Can I get some clarification, please, if I ask a question quickly?
Yes, quickly. Thank you.
So the divorce between what two things? If something was a noun and it ended in N-E-S-S, but I don't know what it was that you said. I couldn't hear all the syllables. Do you remember? Over.
I'm sorry, I don't.
This is Ravi. I'd like to come in again quickly, if no one else wants it.
No, Ravi, we're going to move on. Did he hear Stephanie's question?
Yes, I did. I responded. Maybe I had my mic off. I don't know what words I used. I don't remember.
It's okay. I'll listen later when we have the thing recorded. It's fine. It may come up later on in discussion. Thank you. Over.
Check thorax. It looks like that is what Andrew was referring to, or what Stephanie misheard or didn't hear. So check the IN, Stephanie.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to read the next question. I think Ravi was it who wanted to say something. Please hold your thought until after, if we can sort of bring it into the generalized discussion later. So question 12, what in Hegel did Dunyevskaya part from Lenin? What is the significance of this parting? I'll just read the quote just to get it on record. She says at the bottom of 333, I mentioned that although in the approach to the absolute idea, Lenin mentioned that man's cognition not only reflects the objective world but creates it, but that within the chapter he never developed it. Objective world connections, materialism, dialectical materialism, it is true, but not the object and subject as one fully developed. And then there's a note somewhere, I forgot where it is, but she references C.L.R. James talking about how Lenin saw the gap between the ideal and the real in the Russian workers, whereas they see a unity. I think at the time, this might have been 1949. Over.
Mike, you're referring to page 24. It's at the end of the May 12th letter. So she talked about that gap thing there. Over.
Yes. Thank you, Andrew. Yes. I'll read from a couple of pages out from that. She talks about 1953 and the death of Stalin and how that sort of provoked a further split between her and the Johnsonites.
Well, what page are we on there?
336, middle of 336. The middle paragraph. At the same time, that's when I did get brave and started arguing with Lenin as if he were right there. I mean, arguing with Lenin because he had asked the readers to disregard the last half paragraph of the chapter on the absolute idea, while I insisted that had he suffered from Stalinism for three long decades, he would have seen the relevance of following Hegel's absolutes to the end. And here she's referring to where he says that this is not the last phrase of the logic, but further till the end of the page is unimportant. This is paid back to page 22, but my dear Vladimir Ilyich, it's not true. It is important. And we've dealt with a lot of problems, to say the least, in the last few decades.
It's Anne.
Go ahead, Anne.
Yeah, just continuing down page 336, she clarifies that some more and says she considers Lenin to have remained at the approach to or on the threshold of the absolute idea. And he preferred to let the absolute idea stop at nature or practice, crediting Hegel with stretching a hand to materialism. Instead of following Hegel to the last part of that paragraph, when Hegel insists that the absolutes had not been completed with absolute idea, and he must go further through the philosophy of nature and philosophy of mind before completion is reached with absolute mind. So basically she's saying he was great for bringing dialectics sort of onto the world historic stage in the middle of revolutionary activity, but he didn't go far enough. She's not faulting him. She's not saying, you know, he's at fault for having died, had a stroke and been incapacitated and then died shortly after the revolution. No one's blaming Lenin. We're just trying to see where we should be going. And Donaevskaya obviously thinks we have to be going deeper into the Hegelian dialectic and specifically not stopping while there's still any opposition between the real and the ideal, that we have to overcome that in thought before we can overcome it in reality. So for her, this is very specific in the 53 letters. There's a two-way movement from theory to practice and practice to theory. That is itself a form of theory. There is the possibility of the unity of theory and practice, or the ideal and the real. That would be the new society when we finally take that plunge, have that free release of creativity that can only come about when we have gotten rid of the law of value and are creating something new. So that's where she's going with this parting from Lenin. And she's criticizing herself for not having done more of that earlier, and only, you know, and it's in the 1980s that she's really getting sharp on what's been wrong with all prior Marxists. Over.
This is Ravi.
Yes, Ravi, please.
I think one of the difficulties with this is that if you are sort of, or if Donaevskaya is critical of Lenin stopping at nature rather than reaching to mind and Hegelian ways of sort of expressing these things, then it's basically saying that he methodologically did not lay the groundwork for anticipating Stalinism. I mean, that is what she's saying, and that now, with the benefit of hindsight, we can do that. But it's a bit of a strange way of presenting it, because if you're going to be critical of someone because they are not able to philosophically lay the groundwork by which future developments can be anticipated, then you can do that to an extent, but again, if you take the points that myself and Peter Jones were making about the conditions on the ground in Russia and what was confronting the movement there, then Lenin was very explicit that without revolutions elsewhere from more developed countries, then the undeveloped states on which capitalism had kind of managed to take hold in Russia at the time meant that it was very limited as to how far they could go. And so his whole perspective was linked to what would be required was other revolutions to come to their aid. And in that sense, there is no separation between his philosophical reading of Hegel and what was necessary for the moment, because in the abstract, you wouldn't project a future that was anticipated after the immediate problems that were facing you, because that's just not how anyone works. I mean, you don't abstractly pose questions that the movement or the man is at the moment not able to see in front of them. It's like projecting beyond the immediate can only go so far if it hasn't arrived on the horizons of the person that's formulating it. I mean, I'm not sure if that's clear, but over.
true?
Yes.
I mean, basically, I agree with Ravi there. And I think Dunyevskaya does as well. At the bottom of page 22, she writes, "You see, Vladimir Ilyich, you didn't have Stalinism overcome. When transition revolution seemed sufficient to bring the new society. And that's why he stopped what he did." I think that's just right along the lines of what Ravi would say. Okay, but she says, "Now everyone looks at the totalitarian one-party state. That is the new that must be overcome. So we build with you from 1920 to 23 and include the experience of 3 decades. I think Anne is right. It's not a question of blaming Lenin. It's a question of, for our times, to deal with the problem of counter-revolution from within the revolution. Is this concept of transition that Lenin singles out in his reading of Hegel, and he applies it, you know, like everywhere. For instance, another expression of it is in his analysis of imperialism, Lenin. Another expression of it is in his, understanding of the national revolution, the national liberation struggle of the Irish, a bacillus, I think that's the word, for the proletarian revolution. You know, could that be a transition? So that idea of transition was very much on Lenin's mind, and Dunyevskaya is saying, this is not all that we need today. And I think that that's the parting, and I think the key phrase, and this is at the top of page 23, it's in Hegel, and she italicizes it, or maybe Hegel italicizes it, the beginning of another sphere in science. So what that means is not logic, but the philosophy of mind. And the way Dunyevskaya sometimes put this is that the dialectic of liberation is a dialectic all of its own. It's not the dialectic of the logic. It's not the dialectic impelled by necessity. Freedom has, its own rhythm. And this is what... has to be gotten, and this requires us to move beyond the idea of a party that is grappling with necessity and trying to move us forward. From where we are now, determined by necessity, to the future. In a sense, it's the opposite movement. From the future, that perspective, back into the present. Over.
Can I say something on this, please, Michael?
Absolutely. We have a couple minutes left.
Yeah, how much did Lenin change after reading Hegel? I mean, I'd be interested to see if Andrew could... I'd like to get those sources. You know, you referred to it, Andrew, he discussed the... You can see the changes here, here, and here. I mean, it'd be interesting to look at that. The other thing is, I think, in terms of the revolution, the Russian Revolution, there were 3 slogans, weren't there? There were peace, bread, land. It wasn't a socialist revolution, it was a proletarian revolution. But it was a bourgeois democratic revolution, because the 3 slogans were peace, bread, land. He didn't get any peace. He didn't have any bread. And anyone who looks at anything after 1917, 1918, every visitor says it was terrible, it was almost Stone Age conditions for a vast proportion of the population. And the lands, well, we know, forced collectivization, and so on. So the role of the Revolutionary Party, it was siege of the state, not transformation of the transformation, as opposed to seen afterwards. And this is going back to an earlier question, but it was a bourgeois democratic revolution, and I think, and the capitalists were, as a class, they were very weak, but they were actually, even in 1918, I think there were statements by the Bolsheviks to say that they were controlling the capitalist class. They had no intention of expropriating them. The capitalists actually left and joined the White Army. So capitalism just basically disappeared of its own. The capitalists disappeared of its own volition, of their own volition. Therefore, I think the nature of the Revolutionary Party, did Lenin sufficiently analyse the late, or did he analyse at all the later text, later parts of Hegel's work? Maybe we need to look at another place as well for some of the answer to this, which I think lies mainly in the bourgeois democratic nature of that revolution. Over.
Well, I think in part your question is a good segue to the next question, number 4. According to Dunyevskaya in chapter 9 of the Rosa Luxemburg book, what part does Hegel's dialectic in conjunction with the objective situation play in A, Luxemburg's thinking, B, in Lenin's, and C, in Marx's? So we can dive. Oh, I just read.
Mike, I can't hear you.
Yes, I just realized I muted my mic. But I said that was a good segue, the question, the last question at least, because we're going to this number 4, where Dunyevskaya, we're asked to see what, according to her, what part does Hegel's dialectic, in conjunction with the objective situation, play in Luxembourg's, Lenin's, and Marx's thinking, A, B, and C. So maybe we can answer some of that question of how much did Hegel reorganize Lenin's thought, or how much did Lenin reorganize his own thought after reading Hegel, rather.
I think one of these questions could be dealt with.
Yeah, certainly A, I think. But B and C? I'll just read the concrete part of it is, I think, on 116, where he worked out a political transformation into the opposite, turned the imperialist war into civil war. That follows from the start of the paragraph where the reason why Hegelian dialectics was so alive to Lenin was not due entirely to the profundity of his study, rather it was the objective world situation, the capitalist crisis that brought about the simultaneity of World War I and the collapse of established Marxism. Lenin to single out the absolute method of the idealist philosopher Hegel with absolute negativity. else? Can anybody with the historical background flesh out what that line exactly entailed, to turn the imperialist war into a civil war, so that we're not just at the level of abstraction ourselves? Yes, Ravi.
Well, I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward that the need for the kind of imperialist countries to overcome their problems at home by externalizing a threat and basically trying to grab territory, imperial expansion, meant that the crisis problems at home had to be resolved by the proletariat, saying that no, we don't want your war, and instead we're going to sort of challenge your system itself. That was the sense in which you turned the imperialist war into a civil war. It was a direct appeal to the masses to challenge the kind of militarization of society and the creation of the conditions for war over. Well, of imperialist war, and instead that war should be waged by the workers on the capitalist class itself.
Thanks, Ravi.
It's Anne.
Yes, Anne.
I'll be very brief and abstract, but just to get us moving along, I don't think we exhausted Luxembourg on the dialectic. We talked about Luxembourg's lack of concreteness about Marx's theory and Marxist philosophy, and saying that was for later. On dialectic, she waxed very poetic at some points. She says, the dialectic is the sword by which the proletariat can see beyond capitalism to something else. But it was totally, totally abstract. It didn't play a role in her thinking. For Lenin, it was another matter, but we discussed, you know, didn't go as far as far enough to take us up through the counter-revolution and the revolution. Whereas in Marx, the dialectic is everywhere in his thinking, whether he's talking about commodities, prehistoric development, tracing out the consequences of economic and social conditions. It's never left behind. Everything's always... Well, he calls it the moving and creating principle, and he practices that. I just want to say it's... Dunayevskaya, you know, says to Lenin, you couldn't have known what was going to happen, counter-revolution and the revolution. But what I hope we'll take a little time to talk about is hey, it's 60 years later, 60 years after Dunayevskaya wrote that. So we haven't just had 30 years of counter-revolution, we've had 90. And what does that mean for what we do? What does that mean for whether we need an organization based in philosophy? I don't want to lose sight of that question. That's all over.
This is Stephanie. Are we done with this question yet? Not that I'm in a hurry, but I have a comment to make that I think addresses a lot of different things, but if we're almost, that are related to this, but if we're almost finished with time on this, I'll just hold it till the end of class discussion. Over.
No, we have a little more than 8 minutes left, Steph, so go ahead.
Okay, so in the first thing I want to say is, and this comes from having read Marxism and Freedom, the part of the problem with what happened, maybe the capitalists seem to disappear,
but capitalism didn't disappear either in Russia or what became the Soviet Union or in the rest of the world. And so that was, you know, kind of unforeseeable, maybe, by Lenin when he was doing his writing. And then, of course, he died before he was able to go forward with his writing. But the problem was, the problem is always with capitalism, but the solution is always there. And then turning the imperialist war into civil war, what Ravi said is really important. This whole thing about you people refusing, the proletariat refusing to fight and take on the cause of the capitalist, but to bring forward the struggle, to transform the struggle, if possible, into our own struggle internationally. I mean, if we do it just at home, this is the problem. And the problem with the Civil War in the United States, which was a different kind of civil war, because it really wasn't about getting rid of capitalism, was it? It was about supposedly getting rid of slavery, right? But the reason that we're fighting what we're fighting now worldwide, and particularly in the United States with the police is only an issue, the police brutality is only an issue, and it manifesting in various racist and sexist ways and homophobic ways, is it's harmful, but it's a symptom of capitalism. And the problem is we didn't get rid of capitalism. I hope I'm making some sense. Over.
Anyone else on this question? Okay, let's move along to the last one, the last official question that we had on the agenda tonight. Number 13. According to Dunyevskaya, what is the relationship between the dialectic of the party and the logic of capital? What does logic mean here? How is this related to her criticism of Lenin's focus on transition versus the free release of the idea? Yes, Andrew.
I'll take a shot at it. I mean, this is really not easy stuff, but, you know, I've thought about this a lot. Part of this is a reference to the next to the last chapter of Volume 1 of Capital, the historical tendency of capital accumulation, where Marx talks about the concentration and centralization of capital on the one hand, and the socialization of labor on the other. And Dunayevskaya is understanding this as an absolute contradiction, which is to say that it is not a contradiction that can be resolved or mediated within capitalism. It's the end point of capitalism is this absolute contradiction. This is what Marx is saying brings about the revolution. And Dunayevskaya is seeing an analogy or parallel here between that discussion of Marx's and the absolute idea chapter in The Science of Logic. So that's one connection to logic right there. And if this cannot be resolved from within capitalism, there has to be, just thinking of this philosophically, there has to be a transcendence of this opposition, a new ground, okay? Because the existing ground, which is the objectivity of capitalism, cannot resolve it. And I think that this is then Dunayevskaya saying that the new ground is the ground of freedom. It's again going back to the issue of this new sphere in science of mind, the dialectic of freedom, which is not logic, which is not impelled by necessity and objective condition. So that's, I think, another way of understanding logic here is when you've got logical relations, what comes now is determined by what's come before. So necessity, objectivity moves it along. And I think she's saying that the dialectic of the party is tied into this because the party form is rooted in this logic, so to speak, to misuse the term by using it in another sense here, but it's related. The party form is about this issue of transition. It's about taking the movement where it is now, the objective conditions where they are now, and trying to move forward on that basis. But what if the objective conditions by themselves, what has come before by itself is not enough to bring about the new society? I think that is the problem that Dunayevskaya...
Andrew, you muted yourself again.
Yeah. Okay, what was the last thing that you heard?
You said, what is it that Dunayevskaya...
Okay, so I think what Dunayevskaya is getting at is to get to a new society, we can't rely on objective conditions and just moving forward on the basis of, things that happened and what's come before. We need to bring in the idea of freedom. We need to begin to move backward from the conception of what we're for and make that an element of the contradiction. And in other words, the basis of organization has to be this philosophy of the future. And that's got to pervade every moment of practical and theoretical activity. That's the free release of the idea, which is not a matter of this logical development in the sense of capitalism itself creates the grave diggers, so to speak, but capitalism itself does not do away with itself and create something new. Over.
Hi, this is Ravi. I'll come in at some point.
Sure, Ravi, but before that, I want to ask if anybody else wants to speak who hasn't spoken, either to ask a question or to read a quote or say something else. Okay, Ravi, you're on.
It's something that I put in one of the emails that I posted, which was there's a quote from Marx's contribution to the critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, where he talks about in order to overcome capitalism, you need more than just ideas, but you need material force. And then he says, but an idea becomes a material force when it grips the masses. I think this is just like a very pithy way of kind of summing up what Andrew's just said, which is that when workers have grasped the idea and feel the need to transform our current conditions, and they can kind of project the kind of society that they desire, then the movement itself becomes something that's tangible, and the idea is realised. And I think that's quite a good formulation. Over.
This is Stephanie. Just if people can remember to mute and turn off background programs, because Ravi, I could hear every word, but there was more interference than normal than I've heard so far from your. I don't know if it was coming from you or somebody else's not being muted. Over.
I'm thinking about what was just said in light of the end of the trying to get the date of the letter, essentially at page 24, so the May 12th, 1953 letter on the science of logic, where she ends up, this might have been read before, but just to drive home the point, it's in the middle where she talks about, it appears to me when objective and subjective are so interpenetrated that the preoccupation of the theoreticians and of the man on the street is, can we be free when what has arisen is the one-party state? The assertion of freedom, personal and free and full liberation, takes precedence over economics, politics, philosophy, or rather refuses to be rent asunder into three, and wants to be one, the knowledge that you can be free. I'm sure I have an idea of what some other Marxist groups would say about that.
I'm sorry, what page? The middle of what page?
Middle of page 24. Middle of page 24 in the blue book, The Power of Negativity.
Got it, thank you.
You're welcome. Question: does anybody know anything about what the Hegelian concept of speculative reason is? She references that at the very end of that same letter on page 24.
agree. I think that's just in opposition to deductive reason. So rather than proceeding on factors they're established, it's that projection of possibilities and anticipating the future. I think that's more the meaning of it.
Anne?
Yes, thank you, and go ahead, Anne.
I think it's another term for dialectics, the way it's being used. Where do you see it?
And it's at the very end of her letter, of I think May 12th or whatever it is. It's on page 24.
There's only two letters. Yes, that's the first one.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let me see now. But in general, it's used to mean dialectic. Oh. Yeah. Over.
Okay, anybody else? I don't know if we've exhausted this question, but we're now... We have about 20 more minutes if we factor in the absolute drop-dead deadline of 6:10 when Will has to go. But we have time for any questions or really any thoughts from the class.
Anne?
Okay, go, Anne.
Yeah, I just want to ask the others to speak. We're not looking for compliments here. Oh, I learned so much. It was such a good class or anything like that. I want to come back to the issues we started with, that, you know, maybe we should have taken up questions, if you have the whole wall of questions 5, and 7 that refer back to the critique of the Gotha program. What is anyone concluding about whether this document is just a historic curiosity or a minor part of Marxism, or whether it does provide a very different and perhaps vital key to how we should organize ourselves? So I would really like to spend our time hearing about that and not just to puzzle over philosophy. Over.
This is Stephanie. I think I have a question that relates to this. And if we can just chuck it if it doesn't, but I think it does.
Okay, ask it.
Okay, so this was for Andrew, relating to question number 11 that we covered. Can you explain, I think I know what you mean, but can you please explain the difference, if there is, between what we as a party think versus what we project as theory to the proletariat? I think that's what you were talking about. Because I think that's related very much to the critique. Over.
Andrew?
Yes, Andrew.
Well, I think that this is the entire history of Marxism and every other tendency, is this gap. I think it's that pervasive. And I come back to what Eric said, and I hope Mike is working, but in one of these email messages, he characterized it really well, that, you know, people have this idea that the masses are not ready for socialism. You know, their concerns are higher wages, their concerns are jobs, their concerns are housing, which are all true. But to, you know, take the perspective of Leo Panitch, working people are not inherently revolutionary, because it's not in their genes, even their, you know, biological genes or their blue genes, and we need a party to give them the desire for a new society. So the role of the party, the role of an organization or whatever, is to move them step by step, like pieces, you know, on a game board, till they reach the higher level of consciousness that, that we supposedly have. So what we believe is one thing, and what we project is then something else, because you may have heard this term a lot, because it's very pervasive on the U.S. left. We have to work with people where they are. I don't know if you've ever heard that. I've heard it a lot. And that is an expression right there of the profound gap that people believe exists between the goal of a new society and the subjective conditions that we face right now, rather than the objective conditions. And this gets expressed in a variety of ways, but it's always there. Over.
I have something to respond to with that, but I'll hold it because I want other people to have opportunity. Over.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Hearing no one intervene, I'd like to hear what Stephanie has to say in response.
Okay, so that last thing that you talked about, we have it a lot, you know, I won't complain about Minnesota and all the nonprofits here, but always, I feel that that's it's for people to, that working with people where they're at, it's twofold. People that say that are afraid of losing their own privilege and power, and as they are consciously or unconsciously aware of privilege and power that they have, and it's also a gatekeeping mechanism because it's a bougie way of reaching out and making sure that, okay, well, we'll keep them fed, or we'll give them some health care, or public education, or safe streets, and a, you know, police force they can trust, but that's as far as we're going to go, because the main goal is to keep the mechanisms of machinations, whatever, of capitalism functioning, because everyone's real scared to let go of that, because if we start moving to that new thing, that thing called socialism, people aren't ready for it because they're scared they won't have health care and they won't have their lights on and they'll go back to the Stone Ages and there won't be enough to eat. Over.
Ravi. Yes, Ravi.
I wouldn't be quite cynical as that. I think that one of the problems that people have is that when they're trying to discuss sort of Marxism or political theory or anything to do with new society, they kind of have this separation between what they consider a fairly high-level discussion and then what they are able to interest the average person around them with. And when there is a gap between that, they start to develop an internal language and then an external one, so they'll talk to sort of the public more broadly in a different way that they talk to people inside the organisation. And in some ways that's not that surprising, because when you have some familiarity and you have some grounding and you understand some of the terms and reference points that are being shared, then the discussion can go much further than if you're not new to it. So at some level, that there is going to necessarily be a separation between those who are kind of politically active and those who you meet anew. And the difficulty is that you need to make sure that the gap between those two kind of remains as close together as possible. I mean, it's never completely close, because as I say, that there is the whole kind of shared understanding through which you project things, and that's not something that you can present to people from the outside and expect them to get straight away. There's a kind of gravitation towards understanding that you have to appreciate as a process. And so, but the thing is that you have to take on trust that if you present it well enough, then people will be interested. And if you don't have that basic faith that it's more the pressure is on us to make sure that we are adequate to the task of explaining things at the level that's necessary to appreciate what's going on, rather than continue thinking that, well, they won't understand this, and therefore I won't even try. That's the kind of default position that most kind of political activists will get to at some point. They will dumb it down with the expectation that's where their audience is. And you can't do that. You have to keep working out how to kind of present things in a mediated fashion as possible, that you will take them to the highest possible understanding that you've got yourself. Over.
This is Stephanie. I just want to quickly... I agree with what you're saying, Ravi, but I don't think it was addressing what I was saying. It's talking about something else. I wasn't really talking about the language. I was talking about power relationships and why people say certain things about certain groups, being ready or not being ready, which doesn't have much to do with understanding the oppressed group situation, as it has to do with... There's a certain element of, I don't know, what maintaining power and control over, and I'm not saying it comes from, you know, one group or another, but, well, it does, but anyway, I'll just stop, because maybe somebody else has something to say. Over.
Torev?
Yes, Torev, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to add to what Stephanie said and what Andrew and Ravi said. From my own political practice in Germany, and when I talk to people about these things, there's always one answer. Well, we had 72 years of this, didn't work. We had all the problems with the secret police, we had all the problems with undersupply. And you want to take us there again? So that is the reality I at least face when I engage with people. And from my perspective, there's one thing that, well, maybe it's just me who sees the importance or thinks that these things are important. If we want to engage with people where they are and not at a dumbing down level, as Ravi said, but at really at the high level of understanding that Marx provides us, I said it before, we do need to resolve the question of, this is what Andrew posed earlier, what does it take to smash the law of value? What do we put in its place? And in one post earlier, I said something about the incentive in a society without the law of value to increase or develop the means of production. And those things, I believe, I firmly believe, those are missing. Over.
Peter Jones. Go ahead.
Some people's consciousness certainly does need raising. If you look at, for example, in England, and if those people are from England listen to this, they'll know, say UKIP I mean, where I live in a bootlist, like kind of like this is called the safest Labour seat in England, which means it's always traditionally in the past brought, you know, it's a very working class, lots of very, you know, if you look at, say, the health of people and all indices, it's like rock bottom in terms of, you know, people's living conditions. And UKIP has got a foothold in this area and a number of other working class places. And people, because political parties do shape consciousness, you know, I mean, of course, it can be overcome very, very quickly. It can be overcome almost, not quite instantaneously, but, you know, within the Portuguese Revolution, people talk to revolutionary slogans within hours of the dictatorship falling. But it's the long period between these events, which are kind of, people get this very crystal clear view of what's required and what's necessary. And there are huge periods of time where it's very difficult because, I think as Peter Jones said, you know, it is mixed up. However, I do think that people do, it's not difficult to persuade people, and even Peter Jones might agree with this, on a stall, it's quite difficult. Most people, I think, do see socialism as a way out. I really do think that's the case. There is all this other crap that's floating around, as I said, UKIP and the other parties. But I think socialism is a, you know, I do think we should take that, you know, the high ground. But, you know, we have to, I don't necessarily mean we have to take people from where they are. I think we've got to drag people to where we are. I think we've got to say to people, listen, this is what's required, of course. It doesn't mean day to day, like I'm going to go in this week and I'm going to have to face non-revolutionary situations which will revolve around saving people's jobs. And I won't be able to bring in socialism on any of those things, on any case at all. It will be a desperate struggle to save people's jobs. But that doesn't mean that you don't have an opportunity to raise socialism with those people and raise it in quite a, you know, as a philosophical concept with those people. I think people are ready for those ideas. You know, but, you know, there are these, you know, nevertheless, what you do about this unevenness. And you go knocking your neighbour. If anyone take the challenge and you knock on any of your neighbours' doors tonight or speak to your friends, there is that challenge. There's absolutely no question we've got that challenge. And maybe that's what the, you know, this discussion's been about for the last kind of 6 weeks as well. And it's a question that, you know, I'd like other people to come in on, perhaps.
Anne?
Yes, Anne.
I just want to ask the English, what does on a stall mean? Two people use that term, or else Peter G. used it twice. I don't know what that means.
When you set up a stall and sell political pamphlets or leaflets off it. A table, basically.
Oh, okay. Book table. Okay.
I knew what the term meant because I lived in Australia. And I watch British TV. Over.
We've got stalls in England too.
I've got a question as well after that.
Okay, Andrew goes first, then a question from, was that Ravi or Peter?
Yep, Ravi.
Ravi, and then I think Eric seems to be typing something. We'll definitely read that out when he presses enter, if he does want to say something. But Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try to be extremely brief. I think a lot of the issue is what you hear and what you pick up on. And I think that is the importance of that hamburger recipe story that the Hipsky had never tired of telling, two different attitudes. For instance, Turov's point that people say, God, you know, there were 72 years of this, I'm not going to give my life for something to that's going to turn out like that. That's an extremely profound question, and the challenge to the movement from theory to provide an answer, and damn straight that we have to get that right. So it's not just a question of we have the answers and we have to convince people. We have a lot of hard work to do because people are raising a question at the absolutely highest level, which is what you are proposing going to mean my freedom? And I, you know, look, nobody who, you know, has, people know that what they don't like, they know what's wrong, they're not theoreticians, they don't have the time to work out the answers. So we do need a movement from theory, but it's always a question of what you're hearing from below. For instance, you know, in the 1968 sanitation workers' strike in Memphis, and Martin Luther King was supporting that, and that's when he was murdered. The sanitation workers were holding placards which said, "I am a man." I mean, that connects to the totality of Marx's humanism. Why was a new, you know, turning point not made from that? Over.
Ravi, were you going to add something at this point?
I was, yeah. It's really about the kind of workers that were attracted to Dzhenishkaya's organization during the more kind of politically favorable conditions of the kind of, I don't know, the 60s and 70s, perhaps. Would someone like Charles Denby have been discussing theory along with everybody else who was kind of developing that? Or, because someone said that they carried, I think it was Anne, said that the newspaper used to carry theoretical as well as reports on strikes and various struggles in the newspaper. And I was trying to work out whether would that overcome the tendency for people to gravitate towards what they're most comfortable with, and would most workers not bother reading the theoretical pieces? I'm just curious as to how that worked. Were they joining the discussion? Yeah, it was just basically some background on the experience of your organisations previous to the current downturn in the way in which people see their struggle over.
I want to give you some time, or maybe a couple more moments, to think about an answer for that. But I do want to read Eric's comment for everybody. So just hold off for 1 second, okay?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Eric says, "I'm uncomfortable with the idea of needing to raise people's consciousness, quote unquote, to raise people's consciousness." I say that based in experience growing up in a really poor area and in a generally working class family. When I was growing up, I would used to do an experiment where I'd take out the Marxist jargon and whatnot, which isn't to say they can't understand it. It's just the political stature of Marxism is in question in many places in the rural southern United States where I'm from, and basically present arguments of exploitation, first phase of communism, and all the rest of it. I'd come to the most political, apathetic, or even politically reactionary family I know, and they'd more or less agree with me. So the consciousness is there. I think what the issue is having a voice there to kind of say, hey, we're still here. The ideas are still alive, to get people to know that this alternative isn't actually dead. But going further than that, if I recall correctly, there is a poll done that said a pretty significant minority of people had a positive view of socialism when asked about it. And he says further down, by consciousness here, I'm also assuming that it's the consciousness of needing to transcend capitalism and to pursue something better than it. And it looks like Peter is typing. Some people's consciousness definitely needs raising, especially people who vote for anti-immigrant parties. I agree. And I'll let you, you go ahead. I'll give you the floor.
Okay. I'll try to sum up in 2 minutes. Yes, Peter, there's a fascism, horrible anti-immigrant stuff. We've got a lot of it here. We're living in terrible times where the most reactionary ideas religious fundamentalism in every religion, you name it, all that, but we can't start from that place and get discouraged about talking with people. To answer Ravi's question, I mean, we could have a much longer discussion about Donevskaya's organization in the 50s and 60s. I came in the 60s, so I'm quite familiar. It was a principle to combine theory and practice in one newspaper, not to separate. All the other left had separate journals for theory, and she never did, and she wanted people to have both. If whether everyone took them home and read both, I don't know, but I know that our job doesn't end with publishing a newspaper and handing it out to people. We have to sit down and talk to people about it. And that's what she urged all the members to do, is to meet with these people and discuss the articles with them. That's how we elicited articles from the workers about their workplace struggles and how we discussed the theoretical things with them. And I second what Eric just wrote, that, you know, it is possible to talk to people without using Marxist jargon. But I'm extremely distressed by this discussion, because it seems to me we're back where we were on the first day of class, which is, what do we tell the workers to get them to understand socialism? Maybe we're not so arrogant as to say we have to make them want socialism, but to understand it. And I think we're missing the whole two-way road between theory and practice that Donevskaya worked out. And I'm sort of floored by the deremption between our discussion of dialectics and our immediately going back to, well, what do we say to the workers? Andrew's point about how I am a man can be a very profound statement. It can be very much like Marx's 1844 explorations of humanism and what it means. In the current, just one word on the current demonstrations here, we've been out to some of them in New York, but you can see it on TV, they're giving it a lot of play. The big slogan is, Black Lives Are, what is it? I've gone
Black
blank.
Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter, yeah, Black Lives Matter, which is, in a sense, terribly obvious, but in another sense, is an expression of Marxist humanism and is comparable to the "I am a man" slogan. And what you see a lot of that from ordinary people, and then you see the party people out there with signs that say the only way to end racism is through revolution. Which is undoubtedly true, but it's such an abstraction and not what people are talking about. So what do we do with this? We write it up. I'm working on an editorial for our web journal, but we got to then take it out and talk to people about it. We have been talking to some of these wonderful young people who are demonstrating every day for. Some for 2 weeks, some for longer. It's. I feel like we haven't even gotten up to where Donevskaya was in '53 when she worked out this two-way movement between theory and practice. I really feel like we're in danger of slipping all the way back to the Second International's attitude towards the workers. As people who have to have their consciousness raised. So I would really, really love to hear from the people who haven't spoken about what they think about the whole premise of
can't hear your hand.
Did you cut off there?
Yeah, I couldn't unmute myself, sorry. the whole premise of having philosophy be a basis for organization and what that means, our job is. I just invite people. Oh, we have no more time. Great.
Yeah.
Sorry, over.
We are, perish the thought that we return to Second International. I think we need to continue this conversation, do it online in the email list, and address Anne's final question and final and all of our statements. So, but we'll have to do it in another forum because time is up. So thank you very much. Thank you to Will. Thanks for patience letting us go a little bit over. And thanks to everybody for a great study group, just a great reading group.
Thanks, people. Cheers.